Number 20.
In 1987, the Florida state reptile officially became the American alligator. It was, of course, found statewide. There were very mega fauna, important creatures, up to 14, 15 feet in length and weighing over half a ton, although that's the record, not the average size, unfortunately. They were impressive, dangerous, and we knew a lot about their natural history. However, when you look at the historical context of how the state of Florida ended up naming the alligator the Florida state reptile, I think there are a lot of components involved. If you look at what was happening during the time period and just before the alligator was named as the official reptile for the state of Florida, which incidentally Louisiana beat us to. Louisiana had the alligator as a state reptile in 1983, and after that Mississippi had it in 2005. But in 1967, the gator populations in Florida had become decimated, and it was listed as a state endangered species. By 1973, it was a federally endangered species. Although it was doing well in some states like Louisiana, in Florida, the populations had declined tremendously. In 1987, because of very strong conservation activity, it happens that the Florida alligator came off of the federal endangered species list, and that's the same year that the American alligator was named as the state official reptile. So I believe that is one component. Historical context tells us that if you go back to the early 1900s, that when the University of Florida was founded, which is the official land-grant institution, there was quite a stir in how and what would be the symbol of the University of Florida. There's several stories that come around. One of them relates a merchant named Miller and his son who traveled to South Carolina, obtained a pendant for the University of Florida, which happened to be blue and orange, and he put a gator on that banner that they produced. And that was one story as to how the University of Florida got to be an alligator. The second story was related to a tremendous football player, evidently, who had a bow gator club, and that also was during the same time period. And needless to say, there are other ideas as to how the University of Florida became a gator. Well, why is that important? Well, if you look at the state legislature, you'll see that a very large percentage of the alumni happen to be Florida alumni. I'm Max Nickerson, the curator of reptiles and amphibians at the Florida Museum of Natural History here at the University of Florida.
Number 21.
The Florida Museum of Natural History has one of the largest collections of amphibians and reptiles of any museum in the United States, and this includes a large collection of their skeletons as well. Being in the heart of alligator country, this collection includes a large number of skeletal specimens of American alligators. The large size of this collection makes this a valuable resource for research. We've been able to study variation in the structure of alligator skulls and the changes in skulls that occur as alligators grow. What we've learned from these studies has helped us better understand the differences we see in American alligators and in their fossil ancestors. Bones can tell stories. The long bones in the arms and legs of alligators can be used to determine the age of the specimen at death. If you cut a thin section through the middle of the femur, that long bone in the upper part of the hind leg, it's possible to see rings in the bone development under a microscope. Each ring represents the growth that occurred during the warm, wet summer, and each is distinct from the next because of reduced growth in the fall months followed by the winter dormant season. So you can count these rings to estimate the age of the alligator, just as you can count the rings in the trunk of a tree. This information, learned from alligator bones, has been used by biologists to estimate the age of individual dinosaurs, like T. rex, at the time of their deaths, and to understand that dinosaurs became so big by growing very quickly for many years. I'm Kent Vliet. I'm the coordinator of laboratories in the Department of Biology, and I'm an alligator and crocodile biologist.
Number 62.
By at least the mid-1920s, Cuban tree frogs were established in the Florida Keys, likely having arrived via cargo transported on ships. The species is now found in the majority of counties in Florida, including Alachua County, where the University of Florida is based. Records of this invasive species now extend beyond Florida into neighboring states and as far as South Carolina and Louisiana. This species, native to islands in the Caribbean, including Cuba, is the largest species of tree frog found in Florida and reaches up to 5 inches in length. This hardy species is easily transported by humans and cargo and plants. Females can lay more than 10,000 eggs in a single breeding season. They have a negative impact on local wildlife because they eat native frog species as well as other native species of lizards and insects. In urban and suburban areas, they're common in and around houses and often make themselves conspicuous by clinging to windows on wet nights and making their distinctive raspy mating call. While you can take measures to reduce the number of Cuban tree frogs in your own yard, large-scale eradication efforts will be necessary if we want to effectively remove this invasive frog species. I'm Dave Blackburn, the Associate Curator of Amphibians and Reptiles at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 65.
This python captured the world's attention when removed from Everglades National Park and euthanized by federal scientists in 2012. Brought to the Florida Museum for study, the 17-foot, 7-inch, 164.5-pound snake is the largest Burmese python to have been found in Florida. A female, it also contained a record 87 eggs. The Burmese python is native to a vast reach of Asia, stretching from northeast India to China, as well as portions of the southern Indonesian archipelago. A habitat generalist, it is equally at home on land and in water and is an excellent swimmer. In its native range, it occurs at extremes of elevation from the lowlands of Cambodia to the foothills of the Himalayas in Nepal. Small pythons, up to 8 feet in length, are good climbers that have been found high up in trees. Released through the pet trade, both intentionally and by accident, the Burmese python has been established and reproducing in South Florida since at least 2000. All pythons are constrictors, and the Burmese feeds on mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. Declines in mammal populations coincident with the arrival of the python in Everglades National Park suggest that the python is having a profound effect on the Everglades ecosystem, with survey detection rates for bobcats, possum, raccoons, and rabbits having dropped by 88 to 100% in some areas. Female Burmese pythons may reach sexual maturity in as little as 2 years and lay on average a clutch of 40 eggs annually. The female wraps her body around the incubating eggs and maintains optimal temperature for the developing embryos through a process known as shivering thermogenesis, essentially using finely tuned contractions of her muscles to produce heat. Eggs hatch in about 60 days, and the young are large, approximately 18 inches. Burmese pythons in captivity have lived in excess of 20 years. Efforts to control introduced Burmese pythons in South Florida are made more difficult by the python's cryptic appearance and behavior. The ornate pattern of the python's skin, so attractive to snake enthusiasts, is excellent camouflage across a variety of environments, and their crepuscular to nocturnal activity patterns mean they are most visible when people are at their fewest, and in the dark, at their poorest ability to detect them. Large reproductive females, especially those that have recently fed, may stay hidden for weeks at a time. Perhaps not surprisingly, widely publicized state-sponsored python hunts, while an excellent educational opportunity on the perils of introduced species, have resulted in the removal of far fewer introduced pythons than needed to control the population. In its native range, the Burmese python is hunted for its skin and meat, as well as for the pet trade, and the species is in decline. A greater than 80% decline in Burmese pythons over a 10-year period has been documented in Vietnam. Much more study has been dedicated to the life history and ecology of Burmese pythons in South Florida than in their native range. My name is Robert Robbins. I'm the fish collection manager at the Florida Museum of Natural History, but a fan of all the lower vertebrates, especially the snakes.
Number 92.
Pretend for a moment you are a greater siren, one of the world's largest salamanders, and your pond is drying up. What do you do? Luckily, you have secret superpowers to help you survive. As the water draws down, you burrow into the wet soil, curl up into an S shape, and build a cocoon out of dead cells to withstand the dry conditions. While you do have feathery gills at the base of your head to breathe underwater, you can also breathe air directly through your skin and large lungs. Your body functions slow down, and you can last long periods without eating until the water returns. Pretty handy, huh? Sirens of all sizes have this ability. Larvae, which are less than an inch long at hatching, can survive months like this. Adults grow to over 3 feet long and can weather droughts for years. My name is Kirsten Hecht, and I am a PhD student in the herpetology section at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 104.
In 1968, Wayne King from the New York Zoological Society contacted my father, Walter Offenberg, to find two graduate students to conduct a long-term research program on the island of Komodo, which had never been done before. And my father wrote back and said, well, two graduate students probably wouldn't work very well together for very long. They'd be living on the other side of the island in a matter of months. And he suggested that a family would be much more appropriate and be more successful. He obviously had something in his mind, because several weeks later, we were told at dinner table that we were going to Komodo to conduct a year-long study of the dragon. And our family at that time included my father and my mother, Eleanor, and two younger brothers, Garth and Troy. And my older brother stayed here to continue going to the University of Florida. So we met our father in Jakarta, Indonesia, in August of 1969. From there, we went to Surabaya and then on a ship all the way to Komodo. We spent the next 11 months on the island Komodo. We were the only English-speaking people within hundreds of miles. There was no medical clinic. We did not have a two-way radio. It was much different than it is today. The purpose of the expedition was to learn as much as we could about the Komodo dragon in the time that we had, and my father developed a priority list of things to do, including feeding strategy, activity patterns, etc. And he was very successful in gathering all that data, eventually in 1981 producing the pivotal book on the species, Behavioral Ecology of the Komodo Dragon. Komodo dragons get to be about 10 feet long and are well known as voracious carnivores and predators, and they forage for their food constantly while awake. They are not nocturnal. When they're young, they eat birds and lizards and frogs and insects, and when they get older, they live almost completely off of pigs and deer, both of which were introduced over 100 years ago, which brings to mind, what did they eat before that? We still don't know. Occasionally, they prey on people, both tourists as well as native people. This occurs about once a year, once every couple of years. We've observed them eating live animals, and none of them lasted more than 10, 15 seconds. They grab them by the neck or their hams, and they throw them down, and the animal is eviscerated immediately. There are some new data about Komodo dragons and all monitor lizards. They have a vestigial venom gland in their jaws, and their venom is not like a rattlesnake venom or something like that. It's an anticoagulant, allowing the blood to continue to flow, and the Komodo dragons will track that. And of course, there's also a lot of incidences of infection in the animals that they wound, and they can track that. The conservation of the Komodo dragons is a success story in that they were protected early on by the local folks in Indonesia, and then later on by international law. The area is now included in a national park, and tourism is doing very well in the area. My father was an excellent teacher, and he guided quite a few graduate students through graduate school, mostly in herpetology. And he also guided me into science. The Komodo trip introduced me to Asia, and I decided very quickly that I was not going to study a large predator when I became a scientist, and I didn't. I chose land snails and spent 36 years here at the museum, most of that time working on land snails, particularly Asian land snails. I'm Kurt Offenberg. I was the collection manager in malacology for 20 years and the operations coordinator in exhibits for 16 years at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 106.
The massive alligator snapping turtle is the largest freshwater turtle in North America. Recent research based on the scientific collections of the Florida Museum of Natural History recognized three distinct species. However, this remains debated among scientists, with some arguing that there are in fact only two distinct living species. As more genetic and anatomical data are analyzed for alligator snapping turtles, scientists may find more fine-scale anatomical differences supporting the existence of more than two species. This particular specimen is tied to the strong tradition at the University of Florida of the study of amphibians and reptiles, known as herpetology. The specimen was collected here in Alachua County in 1962 by a young master student named George Zug. Dr. Zug went on to become the curator of herpetology at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. Now retired, Dr. Zug is just one of many examples of students that have passed through the Florida Museum of Natural History and gone on to important roles in the scientific community. Though his work later turned to other topics, including the reptiles and amphibians of both Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands, the collections made decades ago by Dr. Zug and other fellow students in the museum continue to contribute to our understanding of Florida's biodiversity. I'm Dave Blackburn, the Associate Curator of Amphibians and Reptiles at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 109.
The herpetology collections at the Florida Museum of Natural History contains hundreds of thousands of reptile and amphibian specimens. Most of these are preserved whole in alcohol or as skeletonized material, but some specimens, like the salamander, have been treated with chemicals to turn their bones red, cartilage blue, and everything else transparent. This process is known as clearing and staining and has been an important way of looking inside vertebrate specimens for over 100 years. The specimen is kept in glycerin and can be manipulated and moved to see how the bones and cartilage shift around inside the body. In addition to these time-honored techniques, we are also using new methodologies that allow us to look inside our specimens without having to permanently change them with chemicals. High-resolution CT scanning allows us to see bones and cartilage in three dimensions. By staining the animals in iodine before scanning them, we are able to see soft tissues like muscles, blood vessels, and nerves. Once the animal has been scanned, we are able to remove the iodine and return the specimen back to its original state. The Florida Museum of Natural History is part of a multi-institution project that will produce high-resolution soft tissue scans for every family of vertebrates, putting the results online for researchers, educators, or any other interested party to view, explore, and analyze. My name's Edward Stanley, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the herpetology department at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 112.
Everybody knows that Florida has alligators, but many people don't realize that some crocodiles call Florida home. American crocodiles can be found in South Florida, mostly in Florida Bay and the northern Florida Keys, but also as far north as Lake Worth on the Atlantic coast and past Marco Island on the Gulf Coast, with occasional individuals traveling as far north as Sanibel Island or even Tampa Bay. Although the presence of crocodiles in Florida was first suggested in the early 1820s, confirmation of that fact that American crocodiles occur in Florida was not known to science until 1869. This species ranges widely in Central and Northern South America and through the Greater Antilles. So the Florida population is really just the northernmost extent of this broad distribution. As such, this species was probably never too numerous in Florida. These crocodiles don't like cold, and unusually chilly winters in South Florida can kill some of them. In the late 1880s and early 1900s, the species was hunted for its hide and for sport. Coastal mangrove habitats in which crocodiles live were destroyed by development. Large numbers of the crocodiles were collected for exhibition. And as motor vehicle traffic grew in the late 1930s, as people moved into South Florida, road kills took their toll on the crocodile population as well. So the population dropped to dangerously low levels, perhaps only 200 or 300 individuals, and it was placed on the endangered species list in 1975. The salvation of this species in Florida came from an unlikely source, a nuclear power plant. The Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant near Miami constructed a massive series of canals to cool the water used to cool the reactor. These canals, dug out of the hard lime rock soils, covered about 5 square miles. Unintentionally, the soil mounded up between the canals as they were dug created almost perfect crocodile nesting habitat. And as it was located in an area that was completely protected from human intrusion, crocodiles were left to do their own thing. So crocodiles moved in and began nesting. And since then, thousands of baby crocodiles hatched from these nests have dispersed out into other parts of South Florida, including Crocodile Lakes National Wildlife Refuge. There are now about 2,000 American crocodiles living in South Florida, perhaps more than ever existed here prior to their discovery. I'm Kent Vliet. I'm the coordinator of laboratories in the Department of Biology, and I'm an alligator and crocodile biologist.
Number 120.
Indigos are really cool snakes, and they're the largest in North America, north of Mexico. They were listed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service during the 1970s as threatened species. The recent genetic study found two species of indigos in eastern North America, and therefore it cut each of the known geographic distributions by half. My name is Dr. Kenneth Crisco, and I'm the former collection manager in herpetology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 121.
Kingsnakes feed on many small animals, including turtle eggs, rodents, and other snakes, including venomous species. In fact, that's where they get their name, the kingsnake. Kingsnakes were once really common throughout much of Florida. They have experienced drastic population declines over the last 40 years or so. It was thought that there was only one species in our state, but recent DNA and morphological studies showed that there are three, all of which are in need of protection. My name is Dr. Kenneth Crisco, and I'm the former collection manager in herpetology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 122.
I've been monitoring the status of amphibians in the southeastern United States for about 35, 40 years. We started getting reports about disappearances of certain salamander species, especially the southern dusky salamander. And I was concerned about that, and I started looking at museum records, and I found out that in the Florida Museum of Natural History, there was an extensive collection of southern duskies from the 1950s to the 1970s. Now, I live just next to the Devil's Mill Hopper, and one of the collection sites was the Devil's Mill Hopper. So I started a 12-month survey of salamanders in the Devil's Mill Hopper to see what the status of this particular species was. Now, unfortunately, we did not find this animal at all, and we now think it's extinct from the Devil's Mill Hopper. But specimens in the Florida Museum of Natural History allowed us to go back and determine that, yes, the species was abundant there at one time, that all size classes were represented, so we knew we had a very healthy population. And we were able to pinpoint the time of disappearance as about the mid-1970s. We don't know what caused the disappearance of this species, but we can confirm now that it's not there. And indeed, throughout much of the southeastern United States, the southern dusky has disappeared for some unknown reason. My name is Dr. Kenneth Dodd. I'm a courtesy associate professor in the Department of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at UF, and I've been associated with the Florida Museum of Natural History for about 33 years now.
Number 123.
Mud salamanders are typically found along streams, springs, and seeps at low elevations in the eastern U.S. These salamanders are large and robust, typically reddish-brown, reach up to 8 inches in total length, and lay their eggs under rocks and streams. This particular mud salamander has a special connection to Florida. In 1942, this specimen was described as a new subspecies of mud salamander found in northern Florida. This and several other specimens were collected in 1936 on the University of Florida campus by Archie Carr. Dr. Carr was the first PhD in biology at the University of Florida, and is among the state's most well-known naturalists. Like elsewhere across the native range of mud salamanders, Carr found this specimen along a creek on campus. However, the authors that described this new subspecies noted the creek only as Sea Creek because calling it by its real name, Crapper Creek, would have been uncouth in the scientific publication of the time. While this species appears tolerant of habitat loss in many places, it is locally extinct on the campus of the University of Florida. I'm Dave Blackburn, the Associate Curator of Amphibians and Reptiles at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 132.
The Jimbado toad of Ecuador and Colombia is one of several species of golden toad in the genus Atelopus that are found across southern Central America and northwestern South America. Many of these species are today facing population declines and extinction. While the Jimbado toad was previously abundant along streams in the Andes at elevations ranging from 8,000 to 12,000 feet, there were several decades during which this species was not found despite frequent searches. In fact, it was one of a few dozen species that scientists working with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature had officially recognized as extinct. Populations of these and similar toads are believed to have been hard hit by a combination of warming temperatures in the Andes, as well as the spread of a fungus that causes disease and death in many amphibian species. Just last year, scientists working at the Fundación Otonga in Quito, Ecuador, announced that they had finally found a persisting population of this species, which had last been seen in the wild in 1988. The future of these frogs, however, remains murky, as scientists now work to establish captive breeding populations in hope that one day the Jimbado toad might be reintroduced to even a few of the sites from which it has long vanished. I'm Dave Blackburn, the Associate Curator of Amphibians and Reptiles at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 140.
This is a tuatara, a rare and very unusual reptile from New Zealand. The species is the sole living descendant of a lineage of animals that has existed since the Triassic, over 225 million years ago. Like many collections, the herpetology department at the Florida Museum of Natural History contains very little tuatara material, only one skull and one whole preserved specimen. Because they're so rare and so important, these specimens are never loaned out, and so, until recently, access to them has been limited to those researchers that could visit our collections. It's a catch-22 that all collections face. The more rare and important a specimen is, the fewer researchers there are that will have access to it. But new technology is rapidly changing this. X-ray microcomputed tomography is an imaging technique that produces very high-resolution, three-dimensional representations of non-living objects, essentially 3D X-rays. By scanning our tuatara specimens at the University of Florida, we have been able to create digital versions of their skeletons, which can be viewed on a computer or turned back into physical objects using 3D printing. We have made these and many other scans available online, meaning that previously inaccessible specimens are now freely and instantaneously available to view and download all over the world by researchers, educators, and anyone interested in finding out more about these remarkable animals. Feel free to check them out for yourself. My name's Edward Stanley, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the herpetology department at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 146.
In the 1950s, a caged area was developed on campus at the University of Florida between the Florida Auditorium and what was to become Thurlington Hall. That area was then filled with small alligators. Initially, these gators were probably 4-foot animals, and they didn't receive very good overview, and many of them were killed, injured, stolen, escaped. It wasn't a very good situation. In 1957, Ross Allen, who was a reptilian entrepreneur and benefactor to the university, operated the Ross Allen Reptile Institute at Silver Springs, Florida. He donated the first large alligator to the University of Florida, and he donated several others. That animal became known as Albert, and the large animal didn't seem to get picked on as much as the smaller ones. However, at one instance, the Florida State University crew managed to paint it right before a Florida State University football game. They would actually move this large gator in a glass enclosure to the field during football games and other events. So it was indeed a privileged gator from that respect. However, by the 1960s, it was a bit of a challenge to keep moving this animal around. It wasn't always perfect living conditions for the animals. So it was not appropriate to keep it live on campus every day in the open. Actually, it was released into Lake Alice. So that created new opportunities. We see photographs from the 1964 with smaller alligators, so we know they were being used in some ways, at least, in events to highlight Albert and Alberta as mascots. But basically, we had an individual from California who became known as Gator Man, who took a liking to one of the Alberts in Lake Alice. It was a large adult alligator, and he suddenly began to wade into the water to feed it marshmallows, even lying on top of the gator. One day, he noticed that the alligator was lying lethargically on the shore of Lake Alice, and when he approached it, he determined the alligator was quite ill. Therefore, they transported this Albert to the University of Florida School of Veterinary Medicine, whereupon the animal died. And upon death, they conducted a necropsy and found a pop bottle in the intestine which had blocked the digestive tract. Upon that, Mr. Gator, in a sense, left the state. He went to Switzerland and he became quite active in another career. But they stopped using live gators in their performances and switched to mascots, which were in costume. So we see Albert in Alberta and a lot of our University of Florida events, and they were considered the top mascots for the entire nation during one competition. And it's the only mascot with both genders represented, as far as we know. I'm Max Nickerson, the curator of reptiles and amphibians at the Florida Museum of Natural History here at the University of Florida.